This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome into the Yachts and Audibles podcast, Mailbag Monday edition. I'm Matt Preem, Eric Scopel, Jared Mack, all on the show today. We're all in Eugene, a dreary Eugene. It's certainly spring. We've been wanting the cold to go away. The cold has left and entered the rain. And I think that could probably be a good analogy for basketball too. It's been a dreary couple of weeks and it's still dreary. But on the podcast today, it's the mailbag. And I'm surprised by this. Basketball is kind of dominating the questions here. It's not, I think, where we all wanted particularly to go with the questions, but it's a wide range and there was a lot more basketball than expected here.
I think we all thought with spring football starting later this week, we get more there. I think the hard part is it's like, what more do we ask? I mean, maybe we'll pat ourselves on the back and say, gosh, we've just covered all the bases. Everybody knows everything. There's no more questions remaining. I know that's not the case, but yeah, along with Matt, I think Jared probably was surprised that we're talking mostly basketball. I know the tournaments were, both the men and the women did make the NCAA, but we learned that on Sunday, so I understand it's fresh in everyone's mind when these questions are being submitted. And we're certainly addressing both tournaments during this podcast, but we'll start with some football, and it was really the only, I mean, we threw out a question queue, and I was surprised. It's probably the fewest football questions we've had in a really long time. And this is really the only one we're going to answer today, and it comes from Galactic Cero on Twitter. Will the Oregon defense be held back by a defensive line led by many returners who all struggled a year ago? Thank you, Galactic, for throwing a question. I think this is definitely the first question we've answered on the show from him. I don't know if he's asked previous questions. To the question now, I think there's a lot to work on in Oregon's defense, and there needs to be progress made everywhere. I don't think anyone would argue against that. I don't know if I really agree. I think the premise is a little bit of a false one to a certain extent. That's not to say that I think Oregon's defensive line was fantastic last year and full of numerous all-conference defensive linemen. That's not what we saw, but we also didn't see a defensive line that I think that was just absolutely dreadful. I know the pass rush numbers have not been what everybody wants to see. I think that that part you can acknowledge, but if you want to just look at it from how I looked at it, I actually graded the defensive line better than any position group on defense. It was really close between defensive line and the defensive backs. I had a 6.9 for D-line, 6.85 for defensive for the secondary, and then linebackers were a distant third at 6.23. And I think that's genuinely, and we've said this several times in the podcast, where most of the issues on defense stem from. And then if you want to look at it from an individual perspective, Brent Dorlus was the sixth best defensive end in the Pac-12. Jordan Riley was your worst starting defensive lineman. He's gone. He was 17th out of 30 starting interior defensive linemen amongst Pac-12 players. And Casey Rogers was 12th. He is back. So certainly not superstar defensive line play, but you're looking at top half players, top 15-20% players in the Pac-12 at their position groups, at least with Dorlus and Rogers. And then if you want to look at it for how they did against the run last year, they were fourth in the Pac-12, a couple yards behind Washington for third. And I know the reason a lot of people have these issues is because of this game, but if you were to remove the Oregon State game, I think Oregon was either in first or second going into that in the conference and rushing yards allowed and gave up a million. So I know that game is probably where a lot of these issues with the defensive line come from, because before that, I think Oregon's D-line played pretty okay. I'll shut up and listen to Jared and Matt to see if they agree or disagree with kind of the thing I've outlined here. Again, not minimizing need for progress, for improved play, especially from a pass rush perspective. I would just say I wouldn't say everyone who was on the defensive line struggled last year.
Yeah, and I wouldn't either. I think it's fair to be critical of the defensive line last year because that went into a lot of Oregon's defensive struggles. Without a pass rush, quarterbacks were able to stay in the pocket, maintain a pocket presence, and look downfield and hit open players. It's still really difficult to be a defensive back in college or the NFL. You have to stay locked in on somebody. And as we know from Oregon's linebacking core and some of their safety room, they weren't the best coverage or man-to-man coverage defenders. So I had to play zone a lot, which gives a quarterback even more time. But that being said, you know, Brandon Dorlus is still a very productive player. His stats just don't pop up on the scorebook or whatever or after the game on your ESPN app, your Pac-12 app, mostly because he's an interior lineman. And those guys are meant to pressure the quarterback, but it's really easy for mobile and agile quarterbacks to run away, which the Pac-12 is full of, and it will be full of next season. What Oregon was missing the most was an edge rusher. And what we all thought DJ Johnson would have been is somebody who I think Jordan Birch will be. Birch is a South Carolina transfer, former five-star, was very productive in his final season in South Carolina, although South Carolina fans don't think he was that productive, which, you know, it's kind of a home crowd bias there, and somebody who was compared to Jadeveon Clowney at points during his high school recruitment. However, he was still good. He still had over 40 quarterback pressures the entire season, which was a little bit more than Brandon Dorlus. But now adding both those guys onto the defensive front really helps. And then you have all the guys who are coming back, like Eric ran through. Those guys were productive. They just didn't make a significant difference. And that's exactly what Oregon needed last year, was a difference maker. And I don't really think that they had a true difference maker. But this year you bring in guys, you bring in a lot of four-star talent. You bring in Mateo Uiagalelei as well, the highest of the four-star talent. There's more options for there to be a difference maker other than Jordan Birch this upcoming season, not like there was last season. So I think it's okay to be critical of the defensive line last season. I just think there's a context to it all. And I think it's important to explain that context compared to just saying that they were bad. But yeah, at points they weren't great.
I think there's legitimate concern here, because we're banking on the fact that while I do think Birch is going to be a playmaker for Oregon, he had inconsistencies at South Carolina. And you could argue that, well, like the level of competition, the level of play he'll face week in, week out will go down in the Pac-12, meaning his production could theoretically go up. But as we've just seen this season for the basketball teams, just automatically assuming inconsistencies are going to get smoothed out, for another year, just doesn't happen. I do agree with Jared that like Oregon's added a couple other guys. So like last year, it felt like they had one or maybe two guys that you could like pinpoint and say, this is our pass rusher. This is a guy that's going to generate some pass rush, and it's up to him or up to these two or maybe three guys. That number has expanded a little bit, it feels like, going into spring football, but they still have to put it together. I'm not completely like scared out of my mind that Oregon won't have a pass rush, but at the same time, you kind of also have to, believe it when you see it type deal. It's one of these where I think the defensive line will be good, but I think you have to have some kind of reservation going into fall. And then I don't want to say spring, because we saw DJ Johnson generate all those sacks in the spring game. We saw other guys get sacks, and we felt like, hey, this group was going to be good, at least at pass rush. They were solid against the run this past season, but they were terrible against pass rush. The lowest number of sacks since 1986. So I feel good about the run, but defensive line play is a two-prong attack. You have to be good against the run, and you have to be good against the pass. And for the pass one, you have to have some reservations here.
Well, what about the general premise about a defense being held back by poor defensive line play? Do we agree with that sentiment, that that's a major concern?
Yes and no.
Yeah. What do you mean? Like last year's defense was held back by it?
Well, this upcoming year, the way the premise of the question is asked, will the Oregon defense be held back? That's talking about this upcoming season, and he's talking about the returners primarily. I think this, I just wanted to kind of focus this question to answer his question, because we talked about Jordan Birch. We talked about pass rush issues. I think pass rush carries into these concerns about struggles from last year. But I think what this question is getting at is, do we think any of these returning guys are any good? Like, and do we think these guys can be difference makers, and can they take steps? Or is this defense going to be held back by the fact that the personnel is in large part going to be very similar to what it was a year ago, which is the case.
I think last year, like, the overall defense was, you know, particularly the secondary was held back a little bit because they couldn't generate a pass rush. It doesn't matter how good of, you know, of a DB room you have, they can't cover forever. And mm-hmm. so if you can't generate a pass rush, those guys are going to give up plays. And then if you factor in the fact that maybe some of these guys last year weren't elite DBs and you're asking them to cover for now 6 or 7 seconds when, you know, 3 or 4, they're going to be okay at it. Beyond that, that's going to take a significant dip. So, yeah, like I think you could argue that the overall defense was held back a little bit because they couldn't generate a pass rush. But, you know, the overall defense was also held back because the linebacker play wasn't very good. You know, I think you could pinpoint every position group holding back the overall defense.
Yeah, and like Matt was saying, there's a lot of things that you could point to as why the defense was held back. The linebacker room, the pass rush, I guess just the personnel that's not really fitting what a Tosh Lupoi and Dan Lanning defense need. Like, there's been an adjustment in that course in the offseason, especially through the transfer portal and the type of players that they'd like to see assembled for this defense. I guess overall, to answer the question, like, will it be held back by the returners? I don't know. Maybe the returners will get better this offseason. Like, again, this is we're still in March. We have spring camp coming up. And like Matt said, it'll be more important to see what it looks like in September rather than in March. But, you know, I like the guys coming back. I like Casey Rogers. I like Sam Taimani. I like Jordan Riley at the time. I guess, you know, he was just there to be a running down guy. That's why Oregon's rush defense was really good until Oregon State. You still got Popo coming back as well. Brandon Dorlus is an actual dude. He's been one of the better defensive linemen in the Pac-12 for the last couple of seasons. Yeah, and you still have Keon Ware-Hudson as well coming back. So, again, I like the returners. I think that they're all quality players. I just think that Oregon has last year really needed a better edge rusher because, again, when you're a defensive end, unless you're Aaron Donald who can get in and tackle the quarterback, it's a lot easier to – as a quarterback, it's a lot easier to be able to see the defensive lineman coming at you head on and make an adjustment there rather than somebody who's coming from your blindside, which is why they call it a blindside, because you can't see them. So edge rushing is going to be more important this season. I think that Oregon has done a good job stacking up on it. But overall, I like the returners. I like what they did. I think everybody fell in love with Casey Rogers in the Holiday Bowl. I think he's a solid player. Again, I don't know if that's going to hold back the defense because, to Matt's point, there's a lot of things that held back the defense last year. And I think if the defense is held back, I think it'll be a similar proposition this upcoming season.
And that's why I try to reframe it, because I actually am not – like, this is one of the things I'm least concerned about on defense is these mm-hmm. veteran guys on the front line. Like, I understand the lack of a pass rush stats. I think I almost Lou Holtz that right there. Pass rush.
Chris Collinsworth, please.
Was it Chris Collinsworth? I thought Lou Holtz was also rush. Anyway.
I'll stop there.
Love you, Lou. The point I was trying to make is that, you know, you look at the way the defense is set up, like, I don't necessarily think the defensive line a year ago was just atrocious. And I think that feels like the way the premise is being created here. And Galactic, feel free to reach out and correct me if I'm wrong there. But I didn't think a lot of the issues a year ago were entirely due to the defensive front. I thought they kind of did their job most of the time on rundowns. Like, I think you go back and look at the way the season played out, I don't think there were very many games where Oregon got gashed until the Oregon State game. And obviously the Georgia game wasn't great, but that's Georgia. But you look everything in between, and I think it was pretty darn good. And I think that's what I'm getting at, is that this is a group that is experienced. I think there is also some value with that. You know, we're going to get to, I think Jared brought up a good point too, with individual progress and players getting better. And that's something I think we oftentimes overlook. That's something I've been thinking about quite a bit this week as we head into spring. is just the fact that, you know, we've kind of got our entering with our own biases, if you will, about who's good, who's not, who's going to fit here, who's going to fit there. Well, that also discounts what kind of progress players will make in the offseason in this spring. And there's no reason to say that a defensive line group that last year, again, I don't think was terrible, could take a step up and be better. I'm not super concerned there. I'm a lot more concerned about linebacker, and I'm a lot more concerned, I think, about how everything figures out at corner than along the defensive line. But I understand people get concerned because there are some issues on the defense last year, and none of the positions were immune to that. And we'll see what the progress looks like here. But I probably feel significantly better than it sounds like both of you and I think a lot of the listeners are, just about where everything's at on the defensive line. I don't look at it as being a huge hole. Jared, you're shaking your head. Do you disagree?
No, I don't look at it as a big hole either. And that was my whole point. It's like, I like the returners. I think it'll be fine. Whether or not it is what holds back the defense, we'll find out eventually. But I think there's a lot of other spots, like you said, that you could point to where it could hold back the defense. But I like the defensive line. I like the depth, and I like the returners.
All right, let's go on to the second question here. We're going to spend some time now talking basketball, and we're going to close with some golf recommendations for those who are interested. We'll let Matt and Jared kind of get into that here as we close. But we're going to start with the men's tournament. A question from at Levi Cruz 84. How do you feel this NIT seed, or how do you feel about this NIT seed for the Oregon men's basketball team, and how far will they go? First time questioning and a long time listener. Hashtag Audibles, hashtag Ducks. Thank you, Levi, for submitting your first question. Matt, no NCAA tournament. I don't think we've talked in a pod since they were. Well, maybe we had since, no, we haven't, since they were eliminated from the Pac-12 tournament by UCLA at the end of last week, end up in the NIT. Go ahead. What's your instant reaction to how everything's set up, and kind of lay out for the listener kind of where things are going forward?
I think it helped. North Carolina said, we are too good to play basketball beyond the NCAA tournament, because that was going to be a team that was going to be a one seed. I don't know if Oregon would have been a one seed if it wasn't for that. So they get the one seed in the lower left bracket. They've got Liberty, Villanova, Wisconsin, Bradley, Florida, UCF, and then their opponent, the team that they lost to game two of the season, UC Irvine, Wednesday night, chance for some revenge. I mean, I guess there's three things that are important for this tournament, I guess, for the men. First of all, get the 20 wins. That's a streak that's gone 12 straight years. That's important. Dana's talked about that in the past, how it's a sense of pride for the team. Secondly, it's trying, you know, establish, you know, the start of the 2023-2024 season now. And whether that's you give minutes to Biddle, you know, or, you know, more minutes there, or more minutes to Kuznar since he's coming back. Maybe it's trying Khalil Ware in some spots to see how he handles it if he comes back. Their prospects of winning, going, how far do they go? Considering they lost to the first team, you know, the team that they're playing first game, they could lose week one or game one. And I also think they could find themselves in Las Vegas for the semifinals at the end of March. But this team, you have no idea what they're going to look like. I would expect them to beat UC Irvine. I would expect them to beat Florida or UCF, whoever they play in that one. And then after that, you know, you have to play, you know, Bradley is a really good mid-major team. Wisconsin is a solid Big Ten team. Villanova is just like Oregon. They were hurt all year and they're now healthy. I think if you're Oregon, the expectation is that you win at least one game. You should win two. And then beyond that, you're probably, you know, hey, you got a couple games in, all of them at home. Solid run for the tournament, I guess.
I mean, it's always a shame when a team makes the NIT. I feel like it used to mean something, and now it is just a modern day, just big old consolation prize. And, and if Oregon chooses to just play all the youngins, like all the young guys, and just, I don't know, provide rest for Nafale Dante or Will Richardson, I feel like that would be the best course of action. Like, just see what these guys have. And, you know, you want to get to 20 wins, obviously, to continue the streak, like Matt said. I just don't – I don't know. Like, Matt, do you think it means anything if they were to win the chip, the NIT chip?
I don't think it doesn't hurt. I mean, no yeah. one's going to be out here. No one's going to be out here next season going, oh, well, I mean, we're going to win the NIT. Watch out. Like, they're going to, you know, that's a team on the rise. Like, that won't happen. That'll happen regardless of them winning the whole thing or losing, because they've got 3 5 stars essentially coming into the program.
Right.
But ending your season with a win is always a good thing.
Yeah, there's no debating that for sure. It's just, you know, for Oregon, getting another home game is nice, I guess. If people want to come watch the Ducks on a Wednesday night, that hasn't really happened all season long. So I don't know if it'll continue against UC Irvine. Irvine's a good program. They had a good season. They eventually lost to Cal State Fullerton in the Big West semifinals or conference or whatever it is, the quarterfinals. Cal State is an NCAA tournament team. It's a good program there too. It's going to be honestly, if they beat UC Irvine, I don't think it's going to be that difficult of a roadmap for Oregon. I've seen a bit of Florida. They're fine, but they're an SEC opponent, so they kind of have some hype going in. And then eventually it's either going to be Wisconsin or probably Liberty, because Villanova has been so up and down this season. And I don't know anything about Liberty, but I do know that Wisconsin was a bubble team, just like Oregon was. They probably could have had 2 or 3 more wins this season and would have been into the tournament. So I think that would be a good fight. I think they're one of the most talented programs in this NIT. It's just, like you said, Matt, will they put it all together? Because I don't know. Nobody knows. And that's the problem with this whole team this entire year, is they look, you know, they ultimately win against Washington State. They look fantastic in the first half, and then they, you know, blow at one. It was an 18 or 19 point lead overall. It's like it's hard to do, but they did it and nearly lost. And so I could see them losing to Irvine in the first round and having a rather disappointing end of the year. Or, you know, heck, maybe they get to the finals and maybe they go to wherever the finals are. It's in New Orleans, so maybe they go there. Matt, maybe you have a nice road trip in your future.
It's Vegas. It's Orleans Arena, not New Orleans.
Orleans Arena, Vegas.
Yes, Vegas.
Deal.
But maybe I like
another
Vegas
trip. And yeah, I was gonna say that's no problem.
That's so much. That's too much Vegas for you, Matt. I don't want you. That's like an extra Vegas. How much Vegas do you need to do? Plus, I mean, we have our Pac-12 football media day in Vegas this year. I mean, do you need that much Vegas?
No, I don't need that much Vegas. I will say this, though. Like, I am happy that they chose to play and they didn't take the route that North Carolina did. Because I don't know how it just feels – this isn't a tournament anyone wants to be in. I get that. You want to be in the big boy tournament. But to say that you're too good for this just feels – I don't know. I don't know if it's wrong or not. It just doesn't feel right. And so, you know, whether Oregon's going to show up and have any interest in playing or not, we don't know. But at least they're, you know, they're coming out and saying, hey, we're going to still compete. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I understand why UNC said that. Like, I get why they would say that. But
I mean, they're
I do think
number
it's
number one team in the country.
Yeah. And they're, you know, they're real blue blood and all that stuff. And maybe they are too good for it from at least like an aesthetic perspective, but I mean, it's total UNC to go out there and say, oh, we're too good for this, and point their nose at you. But yeah, I agree, man. I think it's good for Oregon to go out there and continue to get some reps, although the games ultimately don't mean anything other than just for pride and for that win streak. But yeah, I think it's fine. I think it helps. I think it's a good thing to keep all the guys in the same team, try to keep the camaraderie up for a lot of them, because, you know, on paper, a lot of them could be coming back. So I think that helps. Yeah. I think it's an opportunity just for guys to potentially prove themselves. So kind of like last season, but again, it's not exactly where you want to be.
Go to break.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll fill up the last two questions of the mailbag.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. Are you still listening? Good. Take a deep breath. You needed a break. This Earth Week, you can live stream seven national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. So, yes, you can literally stream a stream. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.
All right, welcome back to the Odds and Audibles podcast. A couple questions in, a couple more to go.
First question back from at Jack061265.
So many numbers.
I'm wondering if he's born June 12th, 1965. Do we have almost a 60-year-old on the asking the questions? Is that where we are? I like to try to decipher numbers.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with 60-year-olds.
Not at all. My dad's a little over 60. He's a good guy. My mom's over 60. Seems like a nice lady. Anyway, Jack's question. I'm worried for Oregon women's basketball, especially if India Rogers leaves, not much from the perimeter, and a big that barely shoots 50%. I have my thoughts, but I'll ask you what needs to happen this offseason to at least make the NCAAs next year. And if they don't, is KG on the hot seat? Thank you, Jack, for your question. I think this might be a clean sweep. I think all four today, first-time question askers. Love that. Appreciate the new question askers. Means there's maybe we're hitting a new audience, new people listening. Obviously, Levi said earlier he'd been a long-time listener, first-time question asker. Appreciate people jumping in and putting their thoughts out there. This is a tough one. You know, this is a very disappointing season for Oregon women's basketball. Preseason number two in the Pac-12, opened the season near the top 15, I think, in the AP rankings. Had a really great start to the year. I mean, there's a ton of optimism, through November and into December. They were 10-1 going into a game with, at the time, number one ranked Ohio State, who had kind of a down Big Ten run and I think finishes a three seed. But after that, it really didn't go well for Oregon. And, they struggled, I think, for a lot of reasons. You touched on a few here, Jack. Outside of India Rogers, very little consistency from the perimeter offensively. You're right, the bigs down low had a hard time. I think you're referring to Philly, but Grace Van Sluten as well. I know she was first team all-conference freshman, but shot 47% from the field, had significant difficulty with certain types of bigs, I think. I think if you look back at the season, I think Grace went against longer players, maybe a little bit more athletic players. She had a really hard time scoring, getting to her spots, finishing. I think some of that had to do with the ankle issue she had, which impacted her ability to lift. But needless to say, they had a hard time scoring around the basket. And Philly's just very raw. She wasn't particularly consistent finishing. She was a great rebounder, good rim protector, offensively a bit challenged. I think has a better feel than I thought, if I'm being totally honest, because I thought she was actually pretty good up top initiating some of that offense at times with backdoor cuts. Also had some difficulties with some high-low entry passes and catching, but a lot of it you liked. To next season, and I guess before we jump to next season, not to take all the time on this, Oregon is also in the the women's equivalent of the NIT, the WNIT. The field for that has been announced, but the bracket will be released very shortly after this podcast, so I can't tell you what is coming up. But Oregon will host a game, like the men, at some point this week. I have no idea who it'll be against. I don't know what will happen after that. But for those that maybe didn't catch up on that before we jump into next year, let's just kind of tie a bow on the end of this year, which is they are still playing games. They have a chance to win. again, disappointing year, first time in the WNIT since 2016. As to next year, yeah, if Rodgers leaves, that hurts a lot. And I think that we should note there's still a chance that she returns. She has not closed the door on that. Everything I've heard is that it's a decision has not been finalized. That might have changed in the last 10 days since the Pac-12 tournament down in Vegas. Wouldn't surprise me if it has. If she doesn't come back, that hurts a bunch. She was by far your best player. She's an all-conference player, one of the, you know, the 15 players chosen for that. And I think one of the truly one of the 6 to 7 best players in this conference, certainly one of the best perimeter players. If she comes back, that gives you a really impressive starting five, in my opinion. At least it's the same starting five as last year. If she doesn't, you have to replace that spot. Now, to reasons to be optimistic, we've spent a lot of time talking about why not. Player development. Talked about it earlier. Players get better. Oregon starts 3 players that were basically first-year players at this level and first-year starters. We talked about Shea, Van Sluten, also Chance Gray. Those 3 players, you figure, should grow. They should get a little bit better. All those players were playing in completely different roles this year, going through college really for the first time. I know Philly, I'm kind of grouping her in there, but she had 2 years of high school experience before college. She's about as raw as they come coming into college. You saw that. We talked about that. So you expect those 3 to get better, and that's kind of your core for the next 3 years. You hope. You don't know what the portal's going to hold. Sometimes it provides unexpected difficulty. And then you see Tahina Pau-Pau coming back. Shoot, maybe she continues to shoot the ball really, really well like she has now. Maybe this is a launching off point. And next year she can be more consistent. She can step into that Pau-Pau role, or the Rodgers role. That would be the best case scenario. They are going to need a veteran guard to help there. But I think, you know, the other thing that really stands out to me here is I don't know if this roster is very well constructed. And some of it wasn't entirely the staff's fault because of things that were outside of their control. With you wanted to have a little more experience down low, well, that player gets lost for the season. You wanted to have more scorers off the bench, well, that player transfers after 9 games, 10 games. But I think what they really need to do is go find some more long perimeter players, because I think Oregon struggles defending guards in this conference. There's a lot of really good guards. They struggled all season with that against the better guards. They don't really have those wing stoppers that Chance Gray is developing, but she was really your best perimeter defender by a mile. I think they need to find more players there. And they frankly need to find, if Rodgers is gone, they need to go find about the best possible transfer portal point guard they can. They need to go find the top one there, and they need to add a couple bigs. I know they will be aggressive this offseason. I'm told they're going to take up to upwards of 3 or 4 players from the portal. So I think you will see a different looking team. That's kind of how that all lays out. And then I'll let Jared, do you have any other thoughts? And then we can hit the KG on the hot seat thing after.
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, if Rodgers leaves, that's a big portion of your offense just completely gone. I liked what I saw from Grace and Chance Gray last season, but neither of those guys were really good initiators. Like, they couldn't initiate their own shots, which Rodgers could, and Pau-Pau towards the end of the season, once it looked like she got healthier, was able to do. And I think that's a positive for both of those players. But for Gray and Van Sluten, I think that's a step in player development that they need to take in order to initiate their own offense. I expect them to be extremely aggressive in the transfer portal as well, because this is a couple seasons in a row that just don't live up to the standard that they have set, and or the precedent that they've set the last couple of years before the pandemic, basically in 2020. And you know, basketball recruiting was unbelievably hard during that time frame. So that kind of rolls into where they are now in terms of their player development. But you know, I think it's a similar situation as the men's team. I believe that they need more shooting. They need to be able to have somebody who's a knockdown threat, and Rodgers was that. But unfortunately, a lot of her 3-pointers were coming off the dribble. And while she's capable of hitting those, it's just harder. It just is flat out harder to shoot off the dribble than it is to shoot flat footed and be a spot up shooter. And with Rodgers, if she is to come back, she's an excellent playmaker. She hits players open in the corner. She, you know, creates offense for others, creates those open looks that, you know, if you were giving to somebody who shot 39 to 42% from deep and from the portal instead of Elise Hurst, who goes through these unbelievably cavernous ups and downs this season, that would have been a lot more effective than it had been. But again, like you have to keep playing Elise Hurst, because when she gets hot from distance, she's an unbelievable shooter.
You had to play her.
And
you had to
they
play
don't her, have
don't
other
have
options.
Else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's nobody else. And I remember bringing that up at the beginning of the year. It's like, oh, man, they only have like 9 scholarship athletes or 10 scholarship athletes. And then Jenna Asai left And then it became nine, and it's like, oh, that's not good. I'll be interested to see if Kelly Graves adds a walk-on or two this upcoming season, because they might, you know, I feel like they've been kind of burned by just not having anybody else to play. And even if it is a walk-on, you saw like from the men's team when people were decimated by injuries, they at least would put other people in there, and whether or not they would be good is subject to interpretation. They're walk-on, so you know, it doesn't really matter, but they need more options. It's as simple as that. Like you said, Eric, there just wasn't any other option for them to play. It's like, okay, well, we don't have any more guards. And for forwards, it's the same situation. It's if someone got in foul trouble, especially Philly, it's, you know, Oregon was screwed. They just didn't have the size to deal with a team if that other team had size. And you know, to go back to the overall question, if Rodgers leaves, that's a big hole to fill. That's going to be very difficult for the coaching staff to go out and, like you said, Eric, they would have to land one of the top 5 to 10 players in the country in the portal in order to replace Rodgers, because that's what she was at points last season.
Hosendove, Hurst, and Hansen are all gone, right? Like they can't come back.
They've exhausted eligibility.
Yeah. So, like, that gives them what? Eight. I think they have 8 scholarship players for next year currently, when you count in the freshmen that are coming in.
I think it's 9. Nine. Let me do the math up. I'm sorry. I don't have that pulled in front of me here. I'll do it.
The women's programs, they're allowed 15 scholarship players. So right. Like let's just say it's 9. If I'm Kelly Graves, I'm adding 6 players. I'm using all 15 spots. And I'm probably picking a player at every position, and I'm treating it very much like the man named Dan Lanning has done this spring, where he's picked, we'll use Chris Hudson as an example. Chris Hudson's a 2-year starter, and he went out and landed a guy that's a Power 5 starter, and he's going, you know, and Tez Johnson plays the same position. He's trying to go and get Gary Bryant Jr., plays the same position. I would find a player at every position and basically say, hey, Chance, we love you. You're the starter. You started all of last season. We think you can be the starter this season, but we're bringing in another player too to push you, and you got to earn the job again. That's almost how I would treat this season. This so coming off season is.
It's 10. They're at 10 right now.
10 they get 5.
So they, and that I guarantee they want it 5. The reason we hit to lay out, I know we don't want to go into all this, but here's the reason that they had a short roster is because they had almost a full complement the year before, and then everyone transferred because they didn't get enough playing time. And so Kelly thought, and I think I would be curious to get him on a podcast, because I think he'll be somewhat honest in the offseason if he thinks that was the right choice or not. Because he wasn't sure even at the time. I remember talking to him on a podcast last kind of summer, and he was basically like, we'll see. Arizona and us are doing it totally differently. We've decided not to hit the portal, because if we hit the portal, we're then going to create issues on our own roster, and then we're going to have everybody disperse after. We've already been through it 2 straight years. We need continuity, so we're going to go small roster. Arizona went out and filled it. They think they had 14 or 15. You know, neither team had a great season. Arizona obviously made the tournament, so that's better than Oregon. But, yeah, I think 3 is the number to look for here. I think they're going to hit 3 portal players. I think they're going to have 13, which is still really close to the max. That's the approach I'm anticipating.
And you can still do that. You can still do that. Theory though, with 3, you take one really good guard, one really good forward, and one really good center, and basically just challenge, you know, Rodgers, Gray, and Pau Pau, and say, look, we're bringing in one player, and you know, one of you guys is gonna have to, you know, prove that you're worthy of staying in the starting lineup.
I agree with Jared. Finding perimeter shooting is helpful. I was also stunned. I was just trying to see where they rank nationally in 3-point shooting. Jared, do you want to guess where they are, like what their ranking is?
Can I get out of, like, how many teams are we?
Out of all Division I women's basketball teams, which is like 350, maybe? 350, exactly. Man, I guessed it.
Perfect. I know the 3-point total. Do you want to know the 3-point total, Jared, that they shot as a team? Is that cheating?
As a team, the percentage?
No, I'd like to see him. No, I want to see him just guess. Okay. What do you think they are?
Out of 350, man, give me 324.
They're 23rd nationally.
They
were the best three-point shooting in the Pac-12 by about 2 percentage points.
Almost 36% from three as a team.
Yeah, so I think finding perimeter shooting is certainly a value, but I think they're actually pretty good there. Rodgers and Pau ended up shooting about 40% both on the year. Gray was 34%. Hansen was 37%. The issue was
I feel like I'm in the twilight zone. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, because I think
it's because of like what we talked about earlier. They didn't have a lot of players. So when like Pau has an off shooting night, that drastically impacts it because you don't have two or three other players that can make up the slack for the shooting.
It was the issue. Yeah. I mean, it was really what it was is like they were very inconsistent because Pau finishes the season on this tear. And I bet that put them up like a 1 percentage point itself. And then Rodgers was incredible through the first half of conference. They just never stacked it where they were where they were hitting 12 to 13 on 50% shooting. So I think we've addressed a lot of this and we can move on to the last question in a moment, but I did want to hit the last part, which is if they don't reach the tournament next year, is KG on the hot seat? I think if they don't make the NCAA tournament next year, he enters the hot seat the following season. I don't think he's going to get fired after 2 years without an NCAA tournament appearance. I think he's done enough in terms of bringing this program to where they are before. They've made 5 straight tournaments coming into this year. Really should have been 6 because one of the years was the COVID year where they're obviously going to make it as a one seed and one of the favorites to win the whole thing. I don't see a kind of a roadmap for him getting fired at the end of next season, unless they have like a 3 or 4 win total season, which would be a huge disaster. I don't see them heading in that direction. And I kind of think this will course correct a little bit. Maybe I'm just being too optimistic because I do think that, look, they've done well in terms of recruiting portal players in the past. India Rodgers has been very, very valuable for them. Aaron Bowley, you think about what she provided them for years, even before that, Mignon Moore. This year, I mean, I thought Taya Hansen was a valuable piece of the roster. I think they'll do okay in the portal. I think this roster will look a lot stronger. I don't think you're going to go into next year with the same expectations, which might help too, because they were picked 2nd in the conference. They finished 8th. The conference is going to be really good. So my guess is that they enter probably somewhere in the 5th or 7th range in the preseason. And that might not be a bad thing if they end up finishing, I don't know, 4th or 5th in the conference, which is an outcome that could see happening. But that's a lot of stuff that's down the line, and Rodgers coming back will play obviously a huge role in whatever this team looks like next year, because she was undoubtedly your best player. And if she comes back for a 5th year, that would be really big. Did you have something, Matt?
We should also know, I think it's crazy that Kelly Graves is even being discussed as fired, but we should note that he signed a new contract that in 2021 that runs all the way to the end of the 2029 season. So even if it gets disastrous where they don't make the NCAA tournament for 3 or 4 straight years, he's locked in for a while, and it's going to take a pretty significant buyout for the women's side of college basketball to get out of that contract. I'm actually reading your story, Eric. The buyout is $500,000 if it happens before May 31st of 2024. And then it drops down to $250,000 after that. But he's paid $1.3 million through 2029. I don't think he's on the hot seat. I mean, I don't cover the team. Just from my perspective, though, if they don't make the NCAA tournament next season, like, I wouldn't fire him. I would agree with Eric that seat's probably warm going into that next year. But even then, like, I wouldn't probably fire him unless the program just took disastrous turns and fan interest was gone and they weren't even 500. Like, here's the thing. I don't know what the women's attendance records are for the Pac-12 this season, but I can probably pretty much guarantee you Oregon was in the top 3.
They were 2nd.
For the attendance. So
they were 8th nationally last I saw, but that was a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. So like fan support is still there. They're still recruiting at a high level. Sometimes you just hit a bump in the road, and this is probably what that is.
We'll see. Yeah, I think I was just going to say, I think the the idea that Kelly Graves is on the hot seat is very silly. I think he's a very good basketball coach. I think he's had some tough luck here with the COVID run. I kind of talked about it earlier, where the recruiting, where, you know, Kelly brings in the best class of all time at Oregon, and turns out recruiting during COVID is difficult. You don't get to meet with the players. You don't get to see how they actually are. And I feel like that kind of all fell on itself during the same time period. Yes.
I was just going to say, well, life in those 2 years, the year directly after, when that Fab Five class was here, was really difficult. They couldn't even practice together. They had practices split into groups. Like they couldn't even spend time with each other. So you wonder why culture could be a problem. These girls didn't know each other. I mean, I know for a fact, like I'm not sure if some of these girls that were here really ever made it to more than one or two buildings on campus, because all their classes were online and the only buildings they went to were to play basketball. So there was a ton of issues with that too. Yeah.
And that goes into like, well, the men were able to get through it. Well, it's because the men, like, yeah, they lost Peyton Pritchard, but Duarte was back from the previous year. Eugene Amari was on that team redshirting. Eric Williams was on that team redshirting. Will Richardson was on that team. Francis Okoro was back, and Fale Dante was back. All these guys knew each other already. Like the chemistry was basically there. And so even though they played during COVID and they had the same issues that the women did of being able to fully practice, like they knew each other, that they'd played with each other before, and so it wasn't that difficult to conceive them making it to the Sweet 16 like they did.
Yeah, and also they'd all been previous college students, maybe not at Oregon, but they had understood how, you know, college worked and that part of this of it all. And yeah, I just with Graves, yeah, his contract is until 2029. I would be kind of honestly surprised if he wasn't here until then. You know, the fans love him. I think he's a good coach in his own right. Maybe I'm cautiously optimistic as well, but I don't think this is going to be a multiple year period run where they don't make the NCAA tournament. I think this is an important year coming up, because, you know, the last 2 years have been, you know, less than satisfactory, and it's important that they need to, you know, hit hard in the transfer portal and make sure that they continue their player development. And so maybe there's a chance that they could be going, that Kelly could be on the hot seat by the end of next, or by the end of next season. But I doubt it. I don't think it'll happen.
I think both programs go into 2023, 2024, where it's a pivotal moment in their trajectories. It's probably a fork in the road. Like, One road leads to the program going back to where they've been and where they kind of are expected to be. And the other one is probably one where you don't really know where it goes, and it gets bumpy, and, you know, maybe it does lead down to a coaching change. But I still think that's a long road to get to for both programs, because we talk a lot about loyalty and, you know, wanting players to stay and, you know, oh, show the loyalty, don't transfer when it gets, you know, hard and stuff like that. Why do the coaches not get the same effect here? I know it's a women's topic, but this is also a topic that's popped up a lot this season with the men. Like, we have never seen the programs for both the men and the women reach the levels that we've seen, you know, outside of these two head coaches. And people are just so quick to fire them after one and a half bad seasons, two bad seasons.
In general, people are way too quick to want to fire people. That's like a tenet of mine in terms of analyzing all of this stuff. I mean, shoot, we have the longest thread in our message board this last week was a guy saying that Dane Lanning needed to be fired after he ruins the program after this year, because this last year was so bad it set the program back 10 years. So, I mean,
people are back 10 years.
Oh yeah, it's quite a thread there. People who read the message board know what I'm referring to. Like, it was just like, wow, okay, things are not going well. But fans in general, just they want to move on anytime things don't go well from a coaching perspective. It's the easiest place to point fingers, in part because these games are really hard to understand, and you don't want to blame the players, because as Matt said, you want the players to stick around. So you typically, the players you complain about are the older players who can leave and who maybe you don't want to be around, or the coaches. So those are the guys who tend to be the scapegoats, even though it could be the case that all the issues are with the young players, all the fans like, but those guys are always the kind of the favorites, so that's just the way it goes. And I'm in agreement here. I think Graves has, another season next year to, I think if they have a really good year next year, I don't think he's even remotely on the hot seat. I think if they have another down year, maybe he enters the following season sort of on the hot seat. All right. Last question from at L3LACK_dreams. I think that's Black Dreams spelled with a letter L and then the numeral three, which is appreciated. Again, a new question askers. Hey, fellas, flying in from Cincinnati for the spring game. Great idea. And when I get in a round of golf, Matt, where is the best course? Hashtag bots and audibles.
Well, I might defer this to Jared because this sounds, I sound so stupid saying this, but I'm a member at a private club and I only really play at one place. So like,
oh, big shot.
I understand like that comes across as a really dick move. I'm not trying to say that, but I play at one place that's basically and it's a private course, but I would suggest Emerald Valley, but I haven't played Emerald Valley in about a year, but that's that or Tokatee. Those are the two locations I would send you to.
And mind you, Tokatee is very far away.
Yes. Tokatee is 50 minutes away from Eugene, but it's well worth it.
Yeah. Tokatee is a nice course. I mean, I never want to drive that far around here. So maybe
is that,
don't.
Is that the one up the McKenzie?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's a far one. Emerald's really good. Our dear friend Zach Neal at Ducks Wire works there. Mm. So that's a nice perk. Pine Ridge is in Springfield, which is, I guess, if you're staying in Eugene's probably a 15 or 20 minute drive. That might be my favorite. It's got the best views of the Willamette Valley. That's our dear
that's your favorite Bill course. Walden.
It's fun, man. I like it. There's a lot of elevation changes. It's cheaper
but it's
than
so muddy.
Well, in the summer, it's a lot better. But granted, this person will be here in the spring. So yeah, for muddy conditions and course conditions, I'd say Emerald is probably the best to go to. But I like Pine Ridge in the summer, man. When it's nice and dry, the elevation changes. The back nine is pretty meh, but the front nine is beautiful. A lot of nice scenery. Significantly cheaper than Emerald Valley. No disrespect, Emerald Valley, if you're listening to this podcast as a golf club, but yeah, overall there aren't a whole lot of public courses to hit up around here. There are more on the peripherals of, and like, I don't know. There's one up.
If you're coming from Portland,
if you're
coming from Portland, I would stop. This is crazy, but I would stop in Corvallis and play Trysting Tree. Very open course. It's very similar to Emerald Valley, but it's cheaper as well.
Well, and Corvallis isn't that far. If you're going to send them to Tokatee,
those aren't it's the same distance as driving to Tokatee. It's funny because I think in golf, it can everyone's preferences are different and. I agree that Pine Ridge in the summertime is good, but Jared's love of the front nine, I hate the front nine and I love the back nine. And I think that's what makes courses awesome is that you can have the flip flop.
Why do you not like the front nine?
Why do I not like the front nine? Because I've always found the front nine being the more wet of the two. And it's all hilly and mushy and muddy. And some of the elevation changes are kind of ridiculous. Like it's cool to have elevation change, but some of the treks up those hills are just like atrocious.
That's fair, I guess. At least I'm not sending them to Laurelwood.
Yeah. That place had potential, but it's tough.
It's awful. Tough.
Yeah. We need the moral of the story here is we need more golf courses in the Eugene area because the selection is not very good. And I've already joked about it on Twitter, but like there was this tweet, like if you won the lottery, which is like it's like $1.5 billion right now or something like that. This is what you should do from a golf perspective. And I already have a plan. I'd build four golf courses and I've got it all mapped out.
Let's just give him the full experience, Matt. You've been to a lot of the courses in the state. Let's just say he has extra time. We've already given him a couple options that are like an hour away. where else would you have him drive to or visit in the state to play a course? Is there any other places
only,
that he should
only
check
one
out?
Option here?
Well, it's, I mean, it's Bandon. If you're going to play one place in the state of Oregon, it's Bandon Dunes. Good luck getting a tee time though, especially in the spring. And you're going to pay like $450.
Excuse me?
Yeah, it's expensive. It's expensive to play golf at Bandon Dunes in the peak season. That's why a lot of Oregonians go during the winter, because it's a lot cheaper. If you want to go and get Ocean Golf, though, and don't want to pay Bandon Dunes prices, Gearhart Golf Links, that's east of Portland by Haystack. That's a double dip right there. You could get the Haystack photo, see that cool rock feature on the coast, and then also play Gearhart Golf Links. Or you could stay in Lane County and go to the coast and play at Florence Golf Links. Hit up the casino after you're done too. Do that. That'd be fun. Florence is a good course too. I think those would be two ocean courses that if you could play if you don't want to play Bandon Dunes. And that's a drive too, like from Eugene. I did it this year, 2.5 hours, but it's a long drive and it's 2-lane road almost the entire way.
I hope that's enough for Black Dreams there in terms of golf course options. Hope he enjoys his time out west. I'll have to see if maybe he can let us know if he's, you know, how it goes and give us a lowdown on the trip. And if our golf recs, if your guys' golf recs, I don't play golf, so these two are the experts. If their golf recs were very helpful. So,
absolutely. I was not prepared to have Oregon golf talk and it not be Oregon, like University of Oregon, which I would not be prepared for that either. But, all right, that's going to do it for us here on the Odds and Audibles podcast. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for submitting your questions. Wednesday's show will be entirely devoted to spring football. Oregon opens up spring practice on Thursday. We might throw in a little bit of the pro day recap. Jared's going to be at that on Tuesday. So that's what you're going to be looking for this week. And then Friday, we'll have more discussion after that first practice of what we saw during spring football practice. But until then, you've been listening to the Odds and Audibles podcast.
Talk to you later, folks.
Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Peace.
Rise and shine, football fans. This is Susanna Fuller from Morning Footy, a podcast part of the CBS Sports Galazzo Network covering the breadth of the global game. Join me, Nico Cantor, Charlie Davies, Alexis Guerreros, and guests every morning for the perfect blend of news, analysis, conversation, and exclusive interviews. If you love soccer, then look no further. We've got you covered for Europe's top five leagues, the W Gold Cup, the Champions League knockout stage, CONCACAF Nations League, NWSL, MLS, transfer news, and much more. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found. Subscribe to Morning Footy.